Hey everyone, this is Carlos Morales, and this is the Libertarian Atheist Podcast. With us, as normal, is MK Lords. How are you doing today, MK?
Doing great.
So the topic that we want to talk about today is something that's talked about a lot in the manosphere, among feminists, among Tumblr, among social justice warriors, among every single type of social media outlet out there right now, which is essentially the topic of feminism and men's rights advocacy and how they interplay with one another. And trying to decipher some of the more extreme and obtuse views on both sides to try to come up with a more nuanced and kind of more palatable approach so that we're not running on a basically a vengeful platform towards any particular side. In order to do that, what we want to do is present some kind of ideas and where these people are coming from. So when it comes to the men's rights advocacy groups, well, we can talk about a few different things here because they have some what seem like rather valid points. From male disposability to jail statistics, from victims of war to custody battles, and the blatant female siding when it comes to divorce court, it looks like men are getting the short stick whenever it comes to the topic of the patriarchal society. To add on to this, whenever you look at Mattress Girl, Virginia Tech, the Duke Lacrosse stuff, apparently there's a cascade of false rape allegations across America that is destroying man day after day. And this is the narrative, well, at least the narrative being presented by men's rights advocacy groups as of right now. According to them, it's not about hating women, it's about simply trying to help out men by empowering them. But what I've kind of discovered, and it doesn't take very long to kind of figure this one out, is that a lot of what's coming out of the MRA and the MGTOW people is a lot of blatant sexism, misogyny, and victim blaming, a cascade of it really. And the best ways I can see analogy for this is in similar whenever the Nazis and the anti-Semitics would take a specific view of Jews by saying that they have a corrupt manipulative gene inside of them which causes fraudulent banking, cultural Marxism, everything they can do to destroy the white race. Similarly, there is MRAs who are insinuating that there's a genetic predisposition for women to be the manipulative, vengeful, spiteful people. It's a bastardization of evolutionary psychology to justify blatantly misogynistic views. And I do have a few examples of that, well, fuck it. Let's just go ahead and click it over right now. Okay, did that come out better?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
There's still some cutting out, but it'll be fine.
Yeah, it should be a little bit better than that. Okay, so then we'll click back in. Okay, and... MK, when you've been looking into some of these things, like the clips we were just seeing, what's kind of going through your mind whenever you're looking at some of the more sexist and hateful views being brought on by whether it be the men's rights advocates or the brutalist libertarians or some of the people who just seem to be lacking an understanding of feminism as a whole? What are some common traits and where do you think this is coming from?
Well, I think a lot of people assume they know what feminism is and haven't really looked into it, especially if you're familiar with the manosphere and that's kind of your introduction to a lot of feminist theory, then you're going to get a very slanted view of it. And there is a lot of misogyny in the men's rights movement. And I guess when it comes to feminism and men's rights, I've always been of the mindset that I'm very pro-human rights. I don't see why there can't be a gender alliance to work on human rights. And actually, that's how feminism started. And feminism is an extremely broad topic. What does bother me when it's discussed by libertarians is they collectivize all feminists, which you would think they would know better as libertarians not to collectivize people. Feminism has several different schools of thought that are in conflict with each other, actually. And unless you've looked at the history of it and really dived into it, then it's not fair to say that, oh, all feminism is bad and it's ruining the country and, you know, they're all statists and they're all evil. That's not the case. And it's important to define terms too. A lot of people jump ahead of the discussion with terms that are maybe incorrectly defined, like patriarchy and then generally feminism. When it comes to feminism, you have to specify what school of thought you're talking about, because radical feminists the ones that people associate with Tumblr and things like that, are very, very different from gender feminists and equity feminists or individualist feminists or anarcho-feminists. See, there's so many different types, and to collectivize them misses the broader point. And it's really a disingenuous tactic to use when arguing about this. And I found that in talking with libertarians, they don't really have a well-rounded understanding of the history of feminism. And we've both kind of somehow gotten aligned with anti-feminist views, and that was never my intention. I am a libertarian. I'm an anarchist, actually. And about a year ago or so, I started critiquing some feminist theory. You know, I identified as a feminist for most of my life, and I kind of moved into like an individualist feminist view, similar to Wendy McElroy, for example, and libertarian feminism too. And I was critiquing a lot of kind of mainstream feminism, the stuff that you kind of see in the news and the people who are trying to fight the political fight with feminism. So I don't really side with that type of feminist. I don't believe that the answer is to reform these social inequalities through the state. But I am definitely not an anti-feminist, nor do I want to be anywhere closely aligned with the men's rights movement.
So it is fun, though, because I went ahead and I messaged some people and I was talking to them regarding, you know, doing this particular show. Because, I mean, okay, I've gotten in arguments with people who label themselves as feminists over the last, like, year and a half. I wrote this article called, like, Feminist Myths Debunked, and I did all this kind of stuff. So I started getting put in this position, similar to you, where we're both – it was interesting, actually. I think both of us have been called feminist apologists and men's rights advocates at the same time, which I think whenever you're ever like thrown into both groups at the same time, you're probably somewhere in the right, correct? It's kind of like whenever conservatives start calling you a liberal and liberals start calling you conservative, you end up with that nice little mixture of things. And for me, it was more just trying to find some kind of clarity. And so I would look to some of these MRA groups, especially when I was doing my family consultation stuff, so for like legal support and things like that, a lot of fathers' rights groups. I would try to work with those and see kind of where they were coming from, trying to get a better idea. And then what kept on happening was that I found myself almost having to justify the consistent misogyny that was occurring in these MRA forums, in these MGTOW forums, or Reddit and everything else. And I mean, just blatant state making blatant statements of just that women are manipulators. You know, there was actually an article, and here's the thing: I'm going to bring up a few different examples of MRAs kind of being misogynist or whatever. But just so I can have some clarification, some backing as to the original statements I made. From there, though, we're going to go ahead and define these different subsections of feminism because it's important. Because in the same way, if someone if we state that we're an anarchist, they immediately think that, you know, you're going to throw a Molotov cocktail at their face. Similarly, you cannot create that kind of straw man for all these other categories. Because guess what? There's anarcho-capitalism, anarcho-communism, there's libertarian socialism, there's all these different subsections, and they have their own different nuances and concepts. So, but I got to bring up some of this MRA stuff because it's bonkers. There's a guy named Ferdinand Bartomeu, who's a MRA dude. He wrote an article called The Necessity of Domestic Violence, where he claims that women should be terrorized by their men. It's the only thing that makes them behave better than chimps. And argues that women are evolutionary predisposed to wanting to be hit. Though he does make sure to clarify that despite all this, I do not want to recommend you start hitting the girls in your rotation. Mainly because the risks are too great. For every one girl who will pounce on your dick after a good backhand, there are three more who will dial 911 without a second thought. I got lucky, but unless you're exclusively fuck single moms, cougars, and spinsters, you've likely had girls either try to physically hurt you or bait you into hitting them. And then we could also bring up Karen Strawn, who I've had some positive interactions with in the past, but I mean, she's come out pretty big on the justifications of using violence against women and basically blaming women for it on a constant basis. And then you have Paul Elam and just his cascade of shit that he's just been calling activism for the last couple of years. There's a whole laundry list of other individuals who have been basically making a lot of claims that women in almost all these cases of domestic violence are basically asking for it in the same way that a girl who is raped was asking for it by wearing a short skirt. They're saying that there's an initial initiation by the woman in these particular situations, that they're asking for it, and that women have this predisposition to manipulate men, and therefore men have to fight back, or men have to go completely their own way, and make a generalized idea that all women are innately evil. So, in order to kind of set this up, though, so we can actually get some definitions going, do you have kind of a definition that you can give me in regards to patriarchy that makes some sense, so that we can get some bit of clarity?
Yes, so I think patriarchy, when it comes to defining terms, I tend to go with the most obvious term, like the most commonly used way of describing something. So patriarchy is a society or community where men hold the positions of power in government. So this is why I do think that we live in a patriarchal government, for example, in this country, and most governments around the world are patriarchal. They are mostly made up of men, and those men are in the top part of the hierarchy of the power structure. Now, where some MRAs take issue with this term is, and some feminists have put forth this issue, that since we live in a patriarchal society, all men benefit from that. And I will disagree with that. I don't think that because we live in a society where men are at the top parts of the hierarchical structure, that all men therefore benefit from that. I think class plays a role. I think, there are definite, privileges when it comes to race and things like that. So not all men benefit from a patriarchal society.
And patriarchy
and
can also...
Nor does it always disproportionately affect women. I'm sorry, what?
Oh, no. Well, patriarchy, it can also, it doesn't mean that it's helping.
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me at all.
I
can't hear my words right now.
Yeah. Okay, now I kind of can. Something, there's a bad connection or something, I think, with Skype.
With Skype?
I don't know. Okay, I can hear you now. What did you just say?
My name is Carlos. Can you understand me?
Yeah. Could you try maybe talking a little slower? I think Skype is having trouble, or I don't know. It's cutting in and out.
Okay. I'll make sure to, all my internet browsers are off, so I don't think I'm taking too much stuff. I'll turn off my Wi-Fi too on all that. Okay, can you hear me a bit better now?
It's a little choppy still, but...
I'll just speak slower so that it's easier to kind of at least communicate between the choppiness, I guess.
Okay.
Okay. So, I'm going to continue. All right. I'm going to continue from the patriarchy part. I'll edit it and put it together. Fine. When we're thinking about this topic of patriarchy, you brought up a really good point, which is the idea that essentially men are thinking that therefore, because men are in power, therefore men are all of the ones who are going to benefit. But actually, a lot of it has to do with gender norms, which is essentially the idea that the woman is supposed to be the caregiver in these particular cases. So divorce court is a perfect example of this. Within the mindset of the patriarchal mindset is essentially that the man is the one who's supposed to be providing all the money and resources, and that the woman is supposed to take care of the kids. Well, guess what? That's exactly how divorce court works. So that's enacting traditional gender roles in these particular cases, omitting men from the situation, but it is a male, it's that kind of domination paradigm through traditional gender practices that is exacerbating that. And I'm chopping up again.
I caught some of that. I think I can kind of, it's so weird, like you'll start talking and it'll just completely cut out. I don't know if we can just keep going and edit, I guess. I got the main point of what you were saying about gender norms.
Okay. All right. So I'm just going to put this over here and maybe it'll make the computer a bit faster. So it'll be better on that end. Okay. Wait. Why the hell is it doing that? That's stupid. All right. So it's running with less monitor stuff. Okay. So I'm just going to go ahead and... Can you hear me a bit better now? Is this any better? Like, is there a little bit less choppiness?
Keep talking.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay, that it was fine just then. Right before that, it was chopping up. Okay. So I can. Are you hearing me? Am I coming in?
You're coming
choppy?
In great. That's why I seem frustrated right now, because I can't see the issue, because you're coming in like completely fine.
Okay. I got like half of that.
Oh, okay. No. This is so fucking frustrating.
Well, it's like whenever you're not talking about anything that's to do with the show, it's fine. But every
fucking
time you
patriarchy.
Try to make a point, it's like, it cuts off.
And these are good points, god damn it.
I know, they are really good points. I'm sure it's getting recorded on your end. I just can't hear it.
Well, that's important to be able to have the conversation, though. This is going to be so much editing. Anyway.
Okay, I heard editing out of all that. Okay. Okay, let's just brute force this episode. It'll be fine.
We're going to brute force it. All right.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. And it's like 155 degrees in this fucking studio right now. All right.
God.
All right. Ah, and straight through it. Okay. So I just said this whole thing about how patriarchy patriarchy exacerbates traditional family roles and therefore hurts men in family court and in other situations. It's not really beneficial for either side, but it doesn't mean that therefore it's all pushed towards the benefit of women, because guess what? Women many times lose in these situations too, whenever then it, within these divorce courts as well, because it ends up creating these divisions. Did you get any of that?
I got enough. I'll just say this. So I think it's interesting when it comes to patriarchy, maybe a simple way to describe the problems of a patriarchal society would be that when a specific group has power, they're going to have different preferences from the groups that may not have that power. So of course, society is going to start resemble the preferences that they like. And a lot of other people's preferences, whether it's women or, you know, other people who don't have that power, they're going to be left out. For example, we're not even really, we've progressed a lot as far as reproductive rights, but we're still way behind in a lot of ways, even in this country and across the world too. I mean, women having access to safe reproductive health services is actually pretty limited in a lot of areas. And I think this is a direct result of women not being in those positions of power and being able to advocate for their rights and advocate for things that they would prefer to have. And, you know, when I talk about being in positions of power, I also mean to a degree on a social level. It doesn't necessarily have to mean like in government power. But obviously, society is going to be shaped by the people who are in power in government, because that's where these laws and all these other things come from. So that's one way that patriarchy is, you know, directly against the interests of women, for example.
Yeah, and it's certainly hurting them on that case repeatedly. So now that we've tried our best, although people still yell at us for how we defined patriarchy, what I kind of want to get into is also the early history of feminism as a whole. So Christine Hoff Sommers, who does define herself as a feminist, although has critiqued a lot of modern day feminism, has kind of separated some aspects of early feminism. And when I'm talking about early, I'm talking mid 1700s to late 1800s. So she separated it into maternal feminism as well as, egalitarian feminism. So maternal feminism began in part with Frances Trollope, Elizabeth Gaskell, and Hannah More in the early 1800s. It was grabbed onto by the suffragists a little bit later. They viewed their roles as mothers, grandmothers, or matriarchs within the family as not being antithetical to the freedom and liberation of women, but actually can help it. For these women, there was no contradiction between the traditional role of women at home and participation in public life. Their actions in the public sphere were no more than an extension of their role in the private sphere. They projected their maternal role beyond the confines of their own family life. They felt as, you know, as a sister and a mother, they could introduce into politics a unique perspective that issued from the concrete realities of women's lives, including the hardships wrought by things like poverty, abuse, and alcoholism. They also set up a lot of charity boards. A lot of the early not-so-effed-up foster homes were set up in a lot of these places. And female progressives in the early 1900s were also drawn to this, especially those in the British aristocracy and the well-to-do. There was kind of a strong emphasis on gender roles. Now, separate from that, but not completely separate, was egalitarian feminism, which is Mary Wollstonecraft, who basically viewed women and men are equal on intellectual level, and it's not a woman's duty to raise kids or family, as in she doesn't have an obligation to do so. And both sides actually worked with one another positively. In fact, now, you could have, there's obviously criticism as regards to early feminism. There was still racism involved. But guess what? Everyone was racist back then. It's not a justification, but it's just a statement. But both sides tried to dismantle many of the regulations set forth by the government, which promoted patriarchy. So both sides were used, for instance, for the abolishment of rules against women being able to allow to vote. So the suffragists used a lot of these. And both sides, on both sides, you ended up having pro-government people, and on both sides, you also had pro-libertarian individuals. Did that kind of get at least some of the early 1800s stuff? Would you like to add a little bit more to the first wave feminism?
Yeah, well, so, yeah, first wave feminism is what I think most people who identify as feminists think of when they think of feminism. And I do just want to back up to get like a definition of feminism, because I think it does need to be, you know, broadly defined. And I'm just going to use the, you know, Wikipedia. I think this does a good summary. Feminism is a range of movements and ideologies that share a common goal to define, establish, and achieve equal political, economic, cultural, personal, and social rights for women. So you saw, Mary Wollstonecraft to Betty Friedan, a lot of these more first wave feminists were focused on legal rights, you know, getting the right to vote, being able to own your own property, being able to have a bank account, being able to get an education for yourself. A lot of people don't realize that women were not allowed to get into places of higher education. Mary Shelley had to publish Frankenstein under Percy Shelley's name because they would not publish a book written by a woman. And throughout history, you've seen this. It has been very recent in the entire course of history that we've seen more of a move towards gender equality. And I think that's important to keep in mind when people are criticizing feminism and what some of the kind of more radical, government feminists or government activist feminists are pushing for today, that's not where feminism really started, and that's not necessarily what all feminists are trying to promote. So, first wave feminism, again, they were more focused on the right to vote, and, you know, just basic, you know, basic property rights, things that libertarians, I think, can really be on board with. Women did not have, there were even laws, where men were able to have total rights over the children in the relationship. So we see, you know, family court now maybe slanted towards women, but before, women didn't really have legal rights over their own children. So let's see, what are some more of your thoughts on first wave?
So here's in regards to, you know, whenever people are discussing feminism now, they will bring up, well, things are not better for women than ever, yada, yada, which is absolutely true. I think a lot of times, though, context gets lost. We have a good, you know, as far as civilization, industrialization is concerned, the vast majority of history has been men being the ones in power. So as soon as it gets slightly changed or in specific situations, it might be a little bit different. You can't immediately just jump and go, therefore, women are in control now. And everything that's wrong with society is a result of women. And, you know, when I've watched Stefan Molyneux videos where he states that the root of evil and hatred has to do with the matriarchal lineages of awfulness, and that women are the biggest subjugators of pain to humanity, there's an absolute lack of tact and understanding in there. So it's kind of like, to bring up kind of a reference to the anarchist thing again, if I bring up, oh, well, anarchism is now about that guy on Tumblr who's saying that we should burn down Dow Chemical and then ignoring Murray Rothbard or Ludwig von Mises, then you're ignoring the entire story and you're not getting the actual history in that particular situation.
I missed all of the first of that. Could you summarize it briefly and I'll respond?
Yeah, it was essentially, you got to understand the history in order to understand what's going on right now. If you don't understand the beginnings of feminism, then you get this convoluted Tumblr idea of it.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so, where to go from here?
We're just going to do 30 episodes when I'm at your house so that we don't have to ever deal with Skype again.
Right, right. Okay, so yes, there is this, it's very clear, I think, to anyone who understands history that men have been in control in these hierarchical structures forever. And I mean, in a lot of ways, that's because men are stronger and can take that power. There are physical differences between men and women, and, you know, obviously stronger people are going to get higher up in the power structure unless something is done to address that. And this is where feminism comes out of, basically. And so, yeah, there are more schools of thought. Would you want to, let me see.
Yeah, we can get in some more of those thoughts in one moment with a quick break, because I'm going to try to do something to speed up my Skype and make it better.
Yeah.
Because if you can't understand me, this whole thing is a fucking rag, because it's not natural conversations and it's not fun. Part of this
I feel like you're making really good points and it's like, why does it cut off? Like,
part of this is to actually have fun. Wow, my CPU usage right now is 100%. Holy shit. Okay, Chrome, go fuck your mother.
Do you want to try killing Skype and then starting it again? Or is that going to mess up with... Because sometimes that helps with Skype. If you just end it, then reconnect. Ooh, we should talk about the marital rape thing in the 20th century. Yeah. Fun fact: marital rape was legal till 1993.
Is that actually true?
Yeah.
Okay.
In certain states, not all states, but yeah, it finally ended in all states in 1993. Well, and we can tie this back into the kind of the, you know, however you want to call it, the puritanical roots of the country, because a lot of it was, you know, tied in with Christianity and this idea that if you were married, then a woman had no right to turn her husband away, basically. Hmm. So.
Am I coming out any clearer? Or is just...
Keep talking.
Is this all just fucked?
Keep talking, talk faster, and then talk slower.
My name is Carlos. I like to talk a lot, which is why I do radio shows. Yay. No?
Yeah, I could hear all of that. Yeah, I heard all of that.
Okay.
It's like when you start talking faster, for some reason, it cuts out.
Frame rate or something. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. So, where we were at last. Where were we at last?
Do you want to, I just have the general Wikipedia thing brought up here. Do you want to go into mid-20th century feminism? And so some other first wave feminists, one of them is Valtorine de Clare, who is an individualist anarchist. And she actually has some really cool stuff. And her and other first wave feminists fought to criminalize marital rape. and they were unable to do that.
We'll jump to there. So
here, actually, that's late 19th century.
Is it late 19th century? Okay. Is that called second wave then?
No. No, we're still in first wave.
Okay.
It's almost like pre-first. 19th century would be almost like pre-first wave. But it can all be first wave. First wave ended with the passage of the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to cut back in now. And so outside of those first starts there, then we get into some more interesting stuff when it comes to feminism, including people like
Voltairine de Cleyre.
Voltairine de Cleyre. Thank you very much. So since you can actually pronounce it, why don't you talk about some of the benefits and things that particular individual, who I know Nick Ford loves, that they added to the conversation regarding feminism and individual rights.
So Voltairine de Cleyre is very interesting. She was an individualist anarchist, which not all feminists were anarchists. In fact, you know, one could argue that most of them were more focused on political reform during this time. But she worked with other first wave feminists such as Victoria Woodhull and Elizabeth Clark Wolstenholme Elmy to criminalize marital rape in the late 19th century. And these efforts failed. So just for context, when it comes to marital rape, it wasn't fully made illegal in all 50 states until 1993. So when we talk about these evil feminists and their wacky ideas, it's important to realize that marital rape, this idea that, you know, you're being raped by your husband basically is okay and legal and fine, you know, it didn't get criminalized by law, you know, completely until 1993. So that's, you know, like I said, we've made a lot of progress, but that's pretty shocking. It wasn't very long ago. 1993 was not very far back.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.
And so this came from, so when you have patriarchal institutions, a lot of people associate it with religion. So if you go back to the roots of this country, you know, it's puritanical roots in a lot of ways. And the Christian patriarchy, they were the ones who basically gained political power as well. So the marital rape stuff kind of comes out of this idea that women, if you're married to your husband, you're not allowed to turn him down for sex. And this is a concept that they used, that was referenced in the Bible, and that I think some people very, you know, twisted. I mean, if you read the passage itself, you know, it is kind of vague, but people have used passages in the Bible to justify rape. Or what they'll say is, well, it's not rape because the woman is married to him. And, you know, you don't have a right to say no if you're married to someone, which I think anyone, feminist or not, can realize is pretty fucked up. So their efforts actually failed in the 19th century. There were people who vehemently argued that, you know, marital rape was okay. Of course, they didn't call it marital rape, you know. but yeah, eventually, the efforts of, you know, feminists, we overturned this and, you know, we called it what it was, which is, you know, rape. But yeah, Voltairine de Cleyre is very interesting. Another interesting feminist that I think a lot of libertarians can get on board with is Emma Goldman. Now, she was more of a socialist, but she was a socialist anarchist. But she has had some really interesting ideas, too. And these people both were feminists, but clashed with some of the political feminists in their day, too. So for libertarians who say, oh, well, all feminists are statists, that's actually not the case. Again, there has to be nuance here. If you go back far enough, especially in first wave feminism, you did see individualist feminists or anarcho-feminists who said that, you know, it's not enough that we overthrow these, you know, patriarchal institutions on a social level, but also on a state level. And, you know, maybe we can't use the mechanics of the state to do that.
Yeah. And then, so when does it kind of transfer over? So I'm always a little bit confused, and you are more informed in this than I am. I had a sociology major, but I was asleep for the vast majority of my classes. So when did it go from the first wave to the second wave of feminism? Like, when was that transfer? And what did that kind of mean for the philosophy as a whole?
So first wave feminism is basically, it ended with the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. So that's generally seen as the end of first wave feminism. And then afterwards, I mean, there was still a lot of work to be done. Just because women had the right to vote didn't mean we were equal. It didn't mean that we actually even had any kind of political power or influence. There was still a lot of social norms that were being enforced in the way of gender roles and things like that on a social level. So second wave feminism comes around, and this is where you see a lot of divergence in thought. This is where you see, you know, a lot of differing opinions coming out, and it's really, really interesting. This started in the early 1960s, and whereas like first wave feminism focused on suffrage and overturning a lot of the legal obstacles, second wave feminism wanted to talk more about sexuality, reproductive rights, inequalities within the family structure even. And then, you know, there was a legal fight too, but they were more focused on some of these social inequalities. They really wanted to focus on domestic violence and again, the marital rape issues too, that still, you know, hadn't been overturned by the first wave feminists. So some of the things that you see in second wave feminism, a lot of people tried to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have, you know, it would have been a constitutional amendment granting women equal rights. And, you know, I'm kind of, when it comes to, again, I'm an anarchist, so it's one of those amendments. How does an amendment guarantee equal rights? I don't know that I don't think that you can write something on a paper and then all of a sudden, you know, people have equal rights. I think you're still going to have social inequalities with that. So just because, you know, you're focusing on getting an amendment passed, you know, that doesn't really mean we have equal rights. And honestly, like, I don't know, it never ended up passing, but I don't know that it would have been that great for feminism or for equal rights in general, in the same way that having a black president elected means that racism is disappearing.
Yeah, what it can end up actually undermining it. It's kind of like the Civil Rights Act, where it's just like, well, now we all have rights, and therefore the whole black issue is done, right? Because now we have a black president, therefore racism is over, and all these problems are over. And that's the issue when it comes to government, especially how history textbooks are written. Essentially, there's a social problem that exists because of man's innate evil. And then government comes in on a white horse, fixes the situation, names a law after fixing the situation, and then everything is fine. And that's been part of the catastrophe that has been the issues when it's come to feminism's mix with government, or anyone's mix with government at all, is that it taints it completely. But you know, even in this short conversation that we've already had right now, it is abundantly clear that to make this statement that feminism is socialism with panties is quite incorrect when it comes to trying to understand feminism as a whole.
Yeah, and during second wave feminism, you saw things... oh man, I lost my train of thought for a second. Where was I going with that?
During second wave feminism, you saw trains of thought. Okay, government, notes. Socialism, stuff.
Socialism. Oh, crap, I had a really good point.
We are both fucking dying here.
Damn it.
I slept like 4 hours last night.
Oh, okay, got it.
Got it back.
Yes, got it. All right, we're back. Okay, so in second wave feminism, this is where you saw an alliance with the civil rights movement, for example, fighting for, you know, feminists were very closely aligned with other social movements and the anti-war movement, for example. So you've seen, I've heard some libertarians say that, oh, well, the CIA was funding Ms. Magazine and the CIA was funding some feminist organizations. And there may have been some government money going towards these organizations, but if you actually look into the history of it, the FBI, on the other hand, was infiltrating these informations much in the same way that they were infiltrating the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. So government clearly saw these people as a threat. And feminism is not some, you know, government conspiracy to take away men's rights whatsoever. It was taken very seriously by government agencies, so much to the point where these organizations were infiltrated. And that's something to consider, again, when we're looking at the historical battles that feminists have fought, and, you know, especially in regards to the state and power differentials. So let's see. Some other things that happen. Oh, go ahead.
So, you know, it's an interesting point, actually, whenever we start talking about government subsidization, CIA subsidization, in these different cases. Because the more you look into documentation, you'll find that every single movement over the last, say, 100 years has in some way been subsidized by the government and has also been fought by the government at the same time. Reason being, the government has a shit ton of money, and they like to stretch their limbs into every single aspect of everything that's going on. To state that an entire movement is fraudulent because some government money got involved in it is to state that every single movement throughout the last 100 years has therefore been fraudulent, including whomever is talking at that particular time. I've seen individuals like the guys from Gnostic Media trying to knock Terence McKenna because he may have gotten some government money at some point, and therefore the entire psychedelic revolution was a CIA MK Ultra plan. And they've made similar claims in regards to feminism. And I think this is a really absurd kind of way of trying to understand the way in which people think about these things now and the real positive influence that feminism, including second wave feminism, had on how we think of individual rights now and humanitarian rights right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fallacious argument. And I want to go over some of the highlights in second wave feminism where they were focused on things like reproductive health. So and domestic violence. So in 1964, Haven House, this is the first modern women's shelter opened in California. So this is a good thing. Before, it was very hard for women to get help, and it still is. Domestic violence is very misunderstood. A lot of women don't want to speak out about it because they want to protect their partner. And it's still a problem, and I think it's still very underreported, but it was even more so then. And also, there was more of a general societal acceptance that hitting your woman was okay. So, you know, to keep her in line, again, like a lot of the stuff that the men's rights movement say about women's nature has been being said about women's nature for hundreds of years. This isn't anything new. So, they're disobedient and they have to be beaten. And again, you can even trace this back to the Bible in some ways and, you know, some of what's said in there when it comes to husbands and wives and obedience. So a lot of it has its roots there. So another thing that happened in 1965 was a U.S. Supreme Court case, Griswold versus Connecticut, struck down the only remaining state law banning the use of contraceptives by married couples. So this was something that existed. Contraceptives were banned by individual states. So I know libertarians typically tend to argue, you know, federal government versus states' rights, things like that. You're not living. I've never liked that argument because you're not free living in an oppressive, smaller version of a state where you're not allowed to use contraceptives so that you can't get pregnant. So having control over your reproductive system is incredibly empowering because children are very, very expensive and you lose autonomy when you're forced to have a child.
Yeah.
So, I mean, now I think some of the figures are saying, you know, it's like $250,000 a year to have a child, but it's so much more than that. You're losing your physical autonomy. Typically, women are the ones who are stuck with the child. It's much easier for the man to get out of that situation if he so chooses. Of course, there are things like, you know, child support, and the state will force you to pay that. But typically, if a woman gets pregnant, you know, against her will, and she doesn't have access to services that could, you know, prevent that, she's basically stuck with this situation that can be economically debilitating. It could be physically debilitating. You could still die in childbirth. There are all these things that go along with that. And if you don't have the freedom to choose whether or not you want to have children, then you're not really free as a woman. And that it took until 1965 to get to this point where, you know, people were saying, okay, you can't ban someone from using contraceptives. That's crazy. Like, again, 1965 is fairly recent.
Yeah, and I mean, and you brought up, I mean, that's kind of the atheist aspect of this show, but it's also the religious aspect of the state as a whole, which is that so much of this anti-woman mentality has been propagated by religious scripture since religious scripture has existed. The Bible clearly states that the woman is the property of the man. I mean, if you go ahead and look at the Old Testament, it explains how if a man rapes a woman, then he owes the father a certain amount of money, and then he has to marry her, right? That's not exactly positive when it comes to relationships between individuals. And then you have Apostle Paul in the New Testament states that women should be essentially subjects of men, and that it's okay if they are abused because they have to be kept in line. Then they're not allowed to speak within church. All of this stuff is just classic puritanical bullshit. And it blows my mind that right now we've gotten to the situation where there are the paleo-conservative libertarians who are stating that they are fighting for free speech and anti-PC mentality by propagating old-school misogyny, religious domineering forces, and just violence against women as a whole by stating, well, guess what? At least I'm not one of those pussy social justice warriors, which is exactly what I know I'll be called for even making a positive case for feminism whatsoever.
Which is kind of a ridiculous insult if you think about it. I mean, none of those things sound necessarily that bad. And well, I've used it as a joke before, yeah, too, but I've backed away from using the term because of the idiots who use it so frequently.
Well, it's kind of like people right now who are for, like, Donald Trump, and they say anyone who's not for Donald Trump is, like, some kind of progressive leftist white knight. God, I hate the term white knight. Can we just get rid of the word white knight? I don't know what it means half the time. Like, you could just use the word they're pandering in an illegitimate manner to get laid. If that's what you mean by white knight, then I understand it. But if it's just simply someone who states, I really don't like it when you're a misogynist dickhead, well, then it's not so bad. But, you know, it's just more over to that point where when the conversation is getting stagnant because people are repeating concepts without defining their terms and leads to an infinite loop of shame and hatred that helps exacerbate the power of a few amount of people and makes a smaller amount feel empowered while disenfranchising and splintering off a entire section of the population called women from this thing we call prosperity and voluntary exchange of good in the future. So how are we supposed to be able to get there if we decide to demonize any movement which has helped propel over 50% of the population to a point where they're at least allowed to be in a relationship where it's not okay to rape them, where it's okay for them to actually be able to buy property, where it's okay with them to be able to have a job or be able to control their own body. And by labeling people who are for that social justice warriors is just kind of an absurd notion. Although, you know, and God knows, I've been in the position before where I've tried to call out people for being too leftist, and I'm atoning for some of those sins now by helping produce this this content here. Go ahead.
So second wave feminism is really important to understanding the misconceptions libertarians have about feminism. Because, again, when they're talking about feminism and they don't really understand the history of it, in the same way that a lot of people who identify as feminists generally think of themselves in terms of kind of first wave feminism, a lot of libertarians will miscategorize feminism as all of the bad parts of some very tiny vocal minority of second wave feminism. And so to balance things out, this is where some of the bad feminist stereotypes come from, is from second wave feminism. And one of the people who's very often referenced, who had a very small role in feminism, but is often referenced as, you know, an evil feminist, is a person named Valerie Solanas, who wrote the Scum Manifesto. And Scum is short for the Society for Cutting Up Men. This is a person who was very likely mentally ill in some ways. She tried to kill Andy Warhol at one point. She's a very unstable person. This is also where you saw sex negative feminism getting a foothold. So Valerie Solanas is this, you know, she identifies a feminist very strongly, but she wrote this, you know, the Scum Manifesto, and it was all, it's terrible, you know, violence against people, advocating for violence against people, it's just wrong. And she tried to backtrack and say it was satire later, and then it turns out, no, it really wasn't, like, she really wanted to advocate violence against men. Andrea Dworkin is another she was more prominent. She was much more vocal and more prominent as a sex negative feminist who wanted to ban pornography because she viewed all pornography as exploiting women. Similar to some people, how some, and again, it's the same sex negative feminism we see today when it comes to trying to rescue people from sex work, for example, that all sex work is exploitative. That's obviously not true. I would align more with the kind of sex positive view of feminism, which says women choose the occupations that they choose. Maybe women choose to be in pornography because they find that empowering. Who am I to say, really? I'm an individualist, so if people find that type of work empowering, then they should be allowed to do it, and they don't need to be rescued from it because they're too delicate to realize what they're getting themselves into. Women are smart and capable of understanding risks just like men are. So again, this is where you see some of these kind of, you know, more radical viewpoints that have become stereotypes. But I think it's important to note that when it comes to, you know, people like Andrea Dworkin and Valerie Solanas, these were unstable people. They may have had some say at the time, but they're generally not taken seriously. None of their ideas are taken very seriously at all today. And none of them were, there were some, I guess, legal successes, but you haven't seen those carried over today, especially with something like the internet. I mean, any kind of law prohibiting pornography has kind of been superseded by the internet. So,
but you know, but the thing about the sex negative feminism is that it's such an easy target to use whenever categorizing feminism as a whole. It's just like, you know, with Occupy Wall Street, where for the most part it wasn't people trying to throw bricks inside of buildings, but you have about two or three who did it, and therefore you end up classifying all these individuals as being those types of people. It's the perfect man created of straw that you can easily light on fire, because without that straw man, then you'd actually have to talk and try to come up with some goals and solutions to the problems, legitimate issues that they are bringing up, especially at the time.
Yeah, well, like another legitimate thing. So in 1969, California was the first state to adopt a no-fault divorce law, which means you could divorce by mutual consent. And, you know, this was, and they also passed a law regarding the equal division of common property. Whereas before, these, you know, these things were unequal, you know, and, you know, even earlier on, it was much harder for a woman to get a divorce, you know, and if you're in an abusive relationship and, you know, you need to get out of there, you didn't have that right, basically. Again, this can be traced back to some of the puritanical, you know, beliefs too about marriage and divorce.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes to the domestic violence thing, I just want to bring up something real quick. I was listening to a few of these men's rights people, and they were saying that the vast majority of domestic violence cases, women were the ones initiating it. These people don't seem to understand statistics or where the stats come from or how questioning works. Most victims of child abuse state that the reason why they were hit was because they were bad and that they deserved it. Many women in these domestic violence situations have a form of Stockholm syndrome, or they start to believe that this person cares about them by using force against them, and therefore they will state that they were the initiators of these particular cases of abuse. That does not justify domestic violence. That states that the relationship itself is a very harmful one. And to then rationalize it in that way is just so antithetical to any kind of like loving or caring or empathetic idea whatsoever. It's really fucked up. I mean, that's the only way I can kind of classify it. And when I hear women kind of talk about this and yell about it, I just get pissed. Because yeah. it's such a lack of understanding of context too. So,
well, and the biggest problem is these statistics are coming from police departments who were, I mean, they're anti-human generally speaking, but when it comes to cases of abuse and especially rape, there's a lot of sexism involved in that hierarchy still. There's a lot of racism involved. I mean, we're expecting the cops to be reporting this correctly and not asking weird leading questions or, you know, some of these other things. So it's like, we need to look at the source of these statistics, you know, where are they coming from? You know, if they're coming from police departments or something, then, you know, I would be highly skeptical.
And a lot of the stats they bring up too are just bullshit stats. So I'll bring up one. I remember Stefan Molyneux and a few other guys bringing up this statistic that the Air Force did this study where they showed that something like 60 to 70% of all the rape allegations were false. Do you know how they proved that case? They asked the woman if she had any alcohol within the last 24 hours. If she had alcohol in the last 24 hours, therefore it was a false rape allegation.
Oh, wow.
And then they pushed that shit forward. And just how they put those statistics forward, you're just like, how are you not seeing the problems with these? And I mean, there are problems on both sides when it comes to the accumulation of these statistics, kind of like the 1 in 5 or 1 in 4, depending on whichever kind of variable you look at. Maybe it's 1 in 10, maybe it's 1 in 8. We legitimately do not have very good information on either side, but
there's too much rape.
There's too much rape. There's too much fucking rape. And yeah. to then go, men are raped than women. Well, men are generally the ones doing that rape too. And that still doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. I mean, it matters. It's bad on both cases. It's not helpful.
Right. Well, it's not an argument to say that when someone responds that rape is underreported, it's not an argument to say, oh, well, there's a lot, people falsely accuse, you know, rape too. First of all, like, whatever statistics you go by, the false rape allegations are so, so tiny compared to the amount of rape that is not reported. And, you know, it's not reported for a lot of reasons. And it's a humiliating experience if you are raped and you have to report it to the police, and then there's no guarantee of justice. I mean, there's been lots of instances of mishandling rape kits and things like that. But that's not an argument to counterbalance that. No one should be falsely accusing people of rape. I think it legitimately undermines, the ability of rape victims to report and to get help. But to pretend like it's an epidemic is just completely and entirely dishonest.
And then they bring up like these college cases where, yes, there's been some false rape allegations as college cases. But they are acting as if in a lot of these cases it's on the side of women. And if you go ahead and look at how colleges are being told now by the state how to handle rape, I mean, it's absurd. You have colleges which don't have real investigators there. You have university staff who are stating in certain cases, yes, they're always siding with the female. Like, okay, any kind of allegation of rape, this person ends up getting kicked off campus. Well, then you actually have another huge amount of those college cases as well, where, for instance, there was one case where they told the woman that she had to explain in detail how she could have been anally raped without lube. Right, and this was a university professor telling her to do that. Oh my God. Right, so
well, and it's when it fucked comes on to both rape sides. Too, another argument I've heard from the MRA people is like, well, what about prison rape? All these men are raped in prison. Yeah, who's doing the raping?
Well, and I mean, like, let's stop sticking 85% of people in jail right now are there for victimless crimes anyway.
Well, exactly. Well, yeah, that actually, yeah, right. Well, that's a great point too. But when it comes to rape and the violence against men and women, no one should be raping anyone, but there are, you know, there's one gender that's disproportionately doing most of the raping. And I think this is where the feminists have a point. And that's not to say all men are rapists, and that's, and I think this idea is something that is pushed by the more kind of academic, you know, college professor type feminists, is this idea, oh, we need to teach men not to rape. I would think that most men already know this. Rape is a deviant behavior that is not commonly practiced throughout many societies. I mean, it's especially in this country, I don't think we live in a culture that condones rape, for instance. This is where I would diverge from some feminists as far as rape culture. I don't believe we live in a place where rape is condoned. I think it's universally abhorred. And I think, you know, there are very few rapists, and the chances of being raped are lower, but, you know, it is still a threat. And, you know, regardless of the statistics you go by, there's just too much rape going on.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, and it doesn't matter which site you're looking at. I mean, I did an entire presentation on how I don't view rape culture as being this huge part of society where everyone's constantly getting objectified and that men are these inherently bad people, because I'm against the idea of original sin as a whole. And so many different groups try to use original sin. And what I mean by that is that there's some evolutionary type, something in your brain, some meme that causes you to be this despicable human being. MRAs use it whenever they classify certain, just females in general. And then you have radical feminists who then say the same thing about men. And I just get really bothered whenever they just start uttering these stats in regards to domestic violence, these other particular cases, because they're just making such a shit show out of the whole situation and are just going back into the situation yet again where they are trying to sell libertarianism from a point of cynicism, from a hate-filled point, from an intolerant angle, rather than one out of peace and beauty. And honestly, if culture and the state are really just a figment of our imagination, they're just something that exists, but it's really mostly in our mind, then the culture and the state, or the way we think about the state, has to shift. So if the Ancapistan libertarian world we want is based off of basically hating a specific gender, thinking that they're manipulators, thinking that we need traditional family values, which undermine everyone, well, then the statist, the Ancapistan libertarian wonderland isn't one that I'd want to live in anyway. It's not something to try and achieve if what you're trying to achieve is just another fucked up society.
That's right.
On that note, we're actually like an hour and like 20 in. So what I want to do is we're gonna go ahead and go into the other stages of feminism. We're gonna talk a bit more about MRAs, MGTOW, try to bring some more clarity and understanding these particular cases. We've done first and second wave, so we'll get into more of the history and everything else on this. I'm guessing we're probably gonna do, this is basically a three-part guide, libertarian guide to feminism and MRAs, that I think is sorely needed within the communication of this. So of course you can always find our stuff at libertarian-atheist.com, and you can find MK Lords if you just type her in on Google, because God knows there's not a lot of other people named MK Lords. So thank you very much for being on again, MK.
Thanks for having me. It's been cool. A great discussion.
Yeah, it's been good. All right, I'm gonna shut that off. Okay, cool.